Kihiro commenced a series of leaps, gyrating to shake loose his unwelcome rider. Each time they went underwater, Toshio tried to call out.
"You're sentient," he gasped.
"Damn you, Kihiro, you're a starship pilot."
He should be doing his coaxing in trinary, but it was no use trying when he could barely hold on for dear life.
"You pea-brain phallic symbol," he screamed as water slammed against him. "You overrated fish! You're killing me, you goddamn... The ETs own Calathea by now because you fins can't hold your tongues. We never should have taken you along into space."
The words were hateful, contemptuous. At last, Kihiro seemed to have heard. He reared out of the water like an enraged stallion. Toshio felt his grip tear loose, and he was flung away like a rag doll to hit the sea with a splash. Only 18 cases were known in the 40 generations of dolphin uplift, in which a fin attacked a human with murderous intent. In each case, every fin related to the perpetrator had been sterilized. Still, Toshio expected to be crushed in any instant. He didn't care. He had realized at last the cause of his depression. It had come to the surface when he was wrestling with Kihiro. It hadn't been his inability to go home that had hurt these last few weeks. It was another fact he had not let himself think of since the Battle of Morgren. The ETs, the extraterrestrials, the galactics of every stripe and philosophy which were chasing Streaker, would not settle for hunting down the dolphin crewed ship. At least one ET race would have seen that the Streak might successfully go into hiding, or they might imagine erroneously that her crew had succeeded in passing the secret of her discovery to Earth. Either way, the logical next step for one of the more amoral or vicious galactic races would be coercion. Earth might be able to defend herself, probably Omnivarium and Hermes as well. The Timbrimi would defend the Canaan colonies, but places like Calathea or Atlast must be captured by now. They were hostages, his family and everyone he had known, and Toshio realized he blamed the Finns. Another aftershock was due any minute. Toshio didn't care. Pieces of floating debris drifted all about nearby. Not more than a kilometer away, Toshio could see the metal mound. At least, it looked like the same one. He couldn't tell if there were dolphins stranded on the shore or not. A large piece of flotsam drifted near him. It took him a moment to realize that it was Kihiro. Toshio treaded water as he opened his faceplate. "Well," he asked, "are you proud of yourself?" Kihiro turned slightly to one side, and one dark eye looked up at Toshio. The bulge at the top of the cetacean's head, where human meddling had created a vocal apparatus from the former blowhole, gave out a long, soft, warbling sound. Toshio couldn't be certain it was just a sigh. It might have been an apology in primal Delphin. The possibility alone was enough to make him angry.
"Can that crap! I just want to know one thing. Do I have to send you back to the ship, or do you think you can stay sentient long enough to help me? Answer in Anglic and make it grammatically correct."
Kihiro moaned in pure anguish. After a moment of heavy breathing, he finally spoke, quite slowly.
"Don't send me back. They're still calling for help. I will do what you ask."
Toshio hesitated.
"All right. Go down after the sled. When you found it, put on a breather. I don't want you hampered by need for air, and you need a constant reminder. Then bring the sled up near the island, but not too close."
Kihiro flung his head up in a huge nodding motion.
"Yes,"
he cried. Then he flipped and dove into the water. It was just as well Kihiro had left all the thinking to him. The Finn might have balked if he'd caught on to what Toshio had in mind to do next. A kilometer to the island, there was only one way to get there fast and avoid a scramble up the slanting, abrasive, metal coral surface. He checked his orientation one more time. Then a drop in the water level told him that the wave was coming. The fourth wave seemed the gentlest by far. He knew the feeling was deceptive. He was in water deep enough so that the swell came at him as a gentle lump in the ocean rather than a crested breaker. He dove down into the hump and swam against the direction of motion for a time before rising to the surface. He had to gauge it just right. Swim back too far and he wouldn't reach the island before the following trough arrived and pulled him out to sea again. To remain at the front of the wave would be to body surf a vicious breaker out of the beach, undertow and all. It was all happening too fast. He swam hard but couldn't tell if he had passed the peak of the wave or not. Then a glance told him that it was too late for remedial measures. He flipped around to face the looming foliage-topped mound. The breaker started 100 yards ahead, but the island's slope rapidly ate away at the wave as bottom dragged the cycloid into a crested monster. The peak moved backward toward Toshio, even as the wave hurtled upward onto the beach. The boy braced as the crest reached him. He was prepared to look down on a precipice and then see nothing more. What he saw was a cataract of white foam as the wave began to die. Toshio cried out to keep his ear channels open and started swimming furiously to stay atop the churning tide of spume and debris. Suddenly, there was greenery all around. Trees and shrubs, which had withstood the earlier assaults, shook under this attack. Some tore loose of their moorings, even as Toshio flew past them. Others stood and flailed at him as he hurtled through. No sharp branch impaled him. No unbreaking vine garroted him as he passed. In a tumbling, tossing confusion, he finally came to rest, somehow hugging the trunk of a huge tree, while the wave churned and finally receded. Miraculously, he was on his feet, the first man to stand on the soil of Kithrop. Toshio stared dazedly at his surroundings, briefly not believing his survival. Then he hurriedly opened his faceplate and became the first man to lose his breakfast on the soil of Kithrop. Chapter 8 Galactics.
Slay them! The Jofer High Priest demanded. Slay the isolated Thenanin battle cruisers on our 6th quadrant!
The Jofer Chief of Staff bowed its 12-ringed trunk before the High Priest.
The Thenanin are our allies of the moment. How can we turn on them without first performing the secret rituals of betrayal? Their ancestors will not be appeased.
The Jofer High Priest expanded its 6 outer sap rings. It rose high upon its dais at the rear of the command chamber.
There is no time to perform the rites. Now, as our alliance finishes sweeping this sector, as our alliance has become the strongest, now, while this phase of the battle still rages, now, while the foolish Thenanin have opened up their flanks to us, now may we harm them greatly.
The Chief of Staff pulsed in agitation, its outer sap rings discoloring with emotion.
We may change alliances as it suits us, agreed. We may betray our allies, agreed. We may do anything to win the prize, agreed. But we may not do so without performing the rituals. The rituals are what make us the appropriate vessels for the will of the ancients. You would bring us down to the level of the heretics.
The dais shook with the High Priest's anger.
My rings decide. My rings are those of priesthood. My rings.
The oration peak of the pyramidal High Priest erupted in a geyser of hot, multi-hued sap. The explosion spewed sticky amber liquor across the bridge of the Jofer flagship.
Continue fighting!
The Chief of Staff waved the crew back to work with its sidearm.
Call the quartermaster of religiosity. Have it send up rings to make up a new priest. Continue fighting while we prepare to perform the rituals of betrayal.
The Chief of Staff bowed to the staring section chiefs.
We shall appease the ancestors of the Thenanin before we turn on them. But remember, to make certain the Thenanin themselves do not sense our intentions.
Chapter 9 Streaker. From the Journal of Gillian Baskin. It's been some time since I've been able to make an entry in this personal log. Since the shallow cluster, it seems we've constantly been in frantic motion, making the discovery of the millennia, getting ambushed at Morgan, and fighting for our lives from then on. I hardly ever see Tom anymore. He's always down in the engine or weapons pods. I'm either here in the lab or helping out in sick bay. Ship Surgeon McAnee has a mouthful of problems. Ben have always had a talent for hypochondria. A fifth of the crew shows up every sick call with psychosomatic complaints. You can't just tell them it's all in their heads, so we stroke them and tell them what brave fellows they are, and that everything's going to be all right. I think if it weren't for the captain, half of this crew would be hysterical by now. To many of them, he seems almost like a hero out of the whale dream. Krydike moves about the ship, supervising repairs and giving little lessons in kinetic logic. The Finns seem to buck up whenever he's nearby. Still, reports keep coming in about the space battle. Instead of tapering off, it's only getting thicker and heavier. And we're all getting more than a little worried about Hikahi's party. Jillian put down her stylus. From the small circle of her desk lamp, the rest of the laboratory appeared dark and gloomy. The only other light came from the far end of the room. Silhouetted against the spots was a vaguely humanoid shape, a mysterious shadow lying on a stasis table. "Hikahi," she sighed, "where in Ifni's name are you?" That Hikahi's survey party hadn't even sent back a monopulse confirmation of the recall order was now of great concern. Streaker couldn't afford to lose those crewfen. For all of his frequent unreliability outside the bridge, Kipiru was their best pilot. Even Toshio Iwashika had a lot of promise. But most of all, the loss of Hikahi would hurt. Without her, how could Krydike manage? Hikahi was Jillian's best dolphin friend, at least as close to her as Tom was to Krydike or Tisht. Jillian wondered why Takata Jim had been appointed vice captain instead of Hikahi. It made no sense. She could only imagine that politics was behind it. Takata Jim was a Stenos. Perhaps Ignacio Metz had had a hand in choosing the complement for this mission. Metz was a passionate advocate of certain dolphin racial types back on Earth. Jillian didn't write these thoughts down. They were idle speculations, and she didn't have time for speculation. Anyway, it's time I got back to Herbie. She closed her journal and headed over to the stasis table, where a dry, desiccated figure floated in a heavily shielded field of suspended time. The ancient cadaver grinned back at her through the glass. It wasn't human. There hadn't even been multicellular creatures on Earth when this thing had lived and breathed and flown spaceships. Yet it looked eerily humanoid. It had straight arms and legs, and a very man-like head and neck. Its jaw and eye orbits were strange-looking, but its skull still had an Earth-like grin. "How old are you, Herbie?" she asked in her thoughts. 1 billion years? 2? How is it your fleet of ancient hulks waited undiscovered by galactic civilization for so long? Waited until we came along, a bunch of wolfling humans and newly uplifted dolphins. Why were we the ones to find you? And why did one little hologram of you, beamed home to Earth, make half the patron lines in the galaxy go crazy? Streaker's micro-library was no help. It refused to recognize Herbie at all. Maybe it was holding back, or perhaps it was simply too small an archive to remember an obscure race so long extinct. Tom had asked the NIST machine to look into it. So far, the sarcastic Tim Briney artifact had been unable to cozen out an answer. Meanwhile, between sick bay and her other duties, Jillian had to find a few hours a day to examine this relic non-destructively, and maybe figure out what was stirring up the ETs so. If she didn't do it, no one would. Somehow she would make it until tonight.
Poor Tom, Jillian thought, smiling. He'll be coming back from his engines, wiped out, and I'll be feeling amorous. It's a damn good thing he's a sport. She picked up a Pion microprobe. Okay, Herbie, let's see if we can find out what kind of a brain you had.
This ends side one of cassette 2.